Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ben Bernanke says the economy is unusually uncertain. European banks are put to the test. American banks are making gobs of money. And financial reform finally passes. Yeah, just another week in the global economy, I guess. All that coming up today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering young people to achieve educational success beyond high school. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could join us on this Friday, everybody. It is the 23rd of July today. The big question for banks in Europe on this Friday was, what if, as in what would happen if the global economy were to be hit by another recession? European regulators have been curious about that, so they did what the Treasury Department here did last year. They ran stress tests to see how 91 financial institutions might cope. Just 7 failed the health check, 5 in Spain, 1 in Greece, all of them smaller regional banks. That means the continent's big financial guns all got passing grades, which raises the not irrelevant question of just how stressful the stress tests really were. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
European officials might be forgiven for not wanting to put too fine a point on things, so says monetary analyst Ashraf Laidi at CMC Markets in London. He points to lingering doubts whether Europe's banking system can weather the continent's debt crisis.
We are right now at a time when the fabric of market confidence and interbank lending is stretched quite thin.
Laidi suggests Europe's financial physicians were likely careful to avoid delivering any news that might throw the patient back into intensive care.
They did not want to go into a situation where they would impose such stark tests that they would themselves trigger a new blow to market confidence.
Some analysts complain regulators failed to test the worst case, what would happen if a nation defaulted on its sovereign debt. Instead, the test figured on banks holding sovereign bonds to maturity, not what would happen if they actually became worthless in the meantime. At Merck Mitchell Funds, Chief Investment Officer Axel Merck sees the skepticism as healthy.
The pressure will remain on these banks. It's not like the book is now closed and we'll just move on and everything is going to be great in the Eurozone. If there are some deficiencies in the stress test, plenty of us analysts will go out there and pound on the table and say we'd like to have more information.
In fact, European Union sources told Marketplace their report provides the raw data analysts can use to draw their own conclusions. That leaves Merck with one more question. What took so long?
It scares me a little bit that only once every couple of decades a regulator comes in and says, maybe we should check whether you guys can stomach a shock. That is something that should happen every single day.
Merck says the final scores probably won't be as important as that raw data might be in helping calm the markets. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Citigroup stock gave up a bit more than 1.5% today. Tough to know whether that was an actual profit and loss judgment investors were making or the fact that the Treasury Department said today that it's going to unload another big block of Citi shares, part of what taxpayers got in return for their TARP support. The government selling shares is a little bit like you and me selling shares. They call their broker. The Treasury Department has hired Morgan Stanley for the biggest part of the job, but there is plenty of action to go around. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports now from Washington.
Treasury has already sold a big chunk of its stake in Citigroup. Today, officials announced they'll sell $1.5 billion more shares, and Morgan Stanley will get a fraction of a cent for every one of those shares sold. Christopher Whalen is a financial analyst at Institutional Risk Analytics. He says Treasury threw Morgan this multi-million-dollar bone because Morgan needs a little love. Right now, it's the runt of the litter among the big brokerage houses.
Morgan Stanley was arguably the weakest of the remaining firms. So I think part of the reason the Treasury has given Morgan Stanley this business is simply to help them.
And Treasury is trying to help small brokers, too. Morgan is required to subcontract some of the share sales out to a dozen little guys, including small brokerages owned by women and minorities. Now, you may wonder if this largesse will cut into how much the government stands to make from the Citigroup sale. Will the small firms be able to get as good a deal for Treasury? Peter Henning is a former SEC attorney, now teaching law at Wayne State University. He says the little guys may not be able to keep up with Morgan Stanley.
If you have to go to firms that don't have the kind of market depth, they may not be able to sell as many shares at the kind of price that the seller wants.
But Joel Naroff of Naroff Economic Advisors says the small brokers are going to work extra hard to keep up with Morgan Stanley because Treasury will be selling off stock it got from other companies it bailed out, like GM.
If these companies do well, then that holds the potential for them to sometime down the road possibly be brought back in.
There could be an offering of GM stock as soon as this fall. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Other than Citigroup, things actually went pretty well on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Today was something of a farewell party for the government's pay czar. Kenneth Feinberg has plans to step down now that most companies that got significant help from the government are paying back their bailouts. He's going to be running the BP compensation fund starting next month. But before the job change, Feinberg had one last thing to do, a public shaming of 17 companies that handed out huge executive bonuses even as Wall Street and the economy were teetering. Marketplace's Jeff Horowitz reports.
It's called the Review of Prior Payments, a really boring name for some pretty hot stuff. The Obama administration told Feinberg to look at the early months of the financial crisis, before the bailout, before the pay czar, with the entire financial system on the brink, and then tell the American people how richly Wall Street was paying its top executives.
There were significant payouts going on at the same time that these banks were, you know, basically facing insolvency.
Rakesh Khurana teaches corporate governance at Harvard. Feinberg's report found $1.7 billion in payments the pay czar calls ill-advised. Bonuses, stock awards, golden parachutes. They happened at 17 companies that later received bailout money. Khurana says the report's not likely to dent the recovery in Wall Street bonuses, which are back to pre-crisis levels.
Shame or transparency or any type of social pressure, it has very little effect on Wall Street.
Shame was Feinberg's only tool, since these payments were made before the government had any authority. But if Wall Street's not listening, federal regulators might be. The new financial reform bill left lots of blanks, blanks about to be filled in by the SEC and other agencies. Steve Ramirez directs the Business Law Center at Loyola University in Chicago.
The hope here is that by focusing more attention on how distorted compensation was at the height of the crisis, there's more fuel in terms of public opinion for fixing it now.
Regulators need to decide, for example, how independent to make the independent executive compensation committees now required by the law. And they need to flesh out rules to let shareholders weigh in on CEO pay packages. Feinberg's parting shot may remind them not to go easy. I'm Jeff Horowitz for Marketplace.
Sure, we could spend the next 4 minutes of our lives talking about the financial reform bill as a way to cap the 5 days gone by, but really, what's left to say about that? So we're going to go elsewhere for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Here to do that with us are Heidi Moore from The Big Money, also Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Good to be with you, Kai.
All right, so I'm going to posit two seemingly contradictory sets of facts and then let you guys have at them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so here we go. Ben Bernanke on Capitol Hill this week saying the economy is unusually uncertain and then corporate profits that are in the bajillions of dollars. How do you make sense of that?
Sure. Well, it's pretty difficult, but there is a connection in that Bernanke was talking about uncertainty, which apparently took everyone by surprise.
Somehow, right? Yeah.
Right. They've been in Narnia for the past 3 years, I suppose. And upon their return to Narnia, they found that corporate profits are easing upwards, which they are. But it's really no use to the economy because companies are keeping all of those profits to themselves. They're not putting them out in stock dividends. They're not, you know, putting them out and hiring people. They're buying some equipment, but who's running it? It's really just not trickling down as much as people want.
And Kai, this hoarding that we're seeing in corporate profits is really not that all different from what we're seeing with households. People are saving their money more than they did before. They do have that sense of uncertainty that companies do. Growth is too slow for the economy to handle the withdrawal of stimulus, but it's not slow enough to create the political will for any big new programs. And so Congress just got done fighting over unemployment benefits, a relatively small amount of money that will be a modest form of stimulus, but that was all they could get through, which really shows how much of a box we're in right now.
So then what you're telling me, Sudeep, is the government's not going to do anything about this because it can't for two reasons. One is the political will, and the other is it might not do any good anyway.
The Fed has very few bullets left. What it has either won't be effective because it's already brought interest rates so low, or they'll cause other problems. And so you're in this zone where we've got unemployment that is still almost 10%. But what to do about that is really difficult when you've used so much of your ammunition already.
So, Heidi, what do we do?
Well, that's actually a good question because it's not like there are any great alternatives that Bernanke is rejecting, right? Mm-hmm. And so people kind of think that he's not doing enough. And he suggested in his testimony this week that there are apparently secret Fed moves that could take place, but nobody knows what those are. And until we have him transcribe what's in his head, we can't really make any predictions about that. You know, we're stuck. I mean, basically, no one wants to move any of the levers in the economy right now because the real risk we're facing is not that things might get a little bit better if we move something, but that things could get far worse. And we really can't take that second punch in the gut. And so people don't want to play with interest rates. They don't want to play with the Bush tax cuts, which will probably be extended. They don't want to make any sudden moves because we're just afraid this whole thing is going to spiral again.
Sudeep, let me ask you the political question. Are we just going to sit tight now until the fall elections and the president's going to ride it out and Congress is going to ride it out and everybody's going to keep their fingers crossed?
Right. There will be a lot more rhetoric, people talking about what's already been done and trying to make the case with the programs we've seen. But I think most of the American public already has an opinion, one side or another, whether they liked the stimulus, whether they liked the bailout. And so they're going to judge their lawmakers based on that. And there's very little that you're going to see changing in the next few months. It's possible that the economy could improve a little bit going into October, November. By then, we've gotten through some of the uncertainty that came up around the financial regulation bill and around healthcare. But it's not likely that you're going to see anything really phenomenal take place.
Heidi, on that topic of the financial regulation, which is now law, I guess, not a bill, is there anything you'd care to add that hasn't already been said?
I'll add it in about 5 years when financial regulation actually takes place, because right now it's incredibly difficult to tell what it really means. A lot of it is, you know, commissioning studies or waiting for some future point to figure out what's going on in finance. It's not a real law. It's more of a fact-finding mission. So in 5 years, we'll talk.
All right, we'll do that. Heidi Moore, she writes for The Big Money. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal down in Washington, D.C. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, the grim, dry future of the Colorado River.
Without this water source and without the power and agriculture it provides, you know, these economies would not be booming the way that they are, and that many people should not live there.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose just shy of 1% today, 102 points, closed at 10,424. The NASDAQ nipped up just over 1%, 23 points, ended at 2269. The S&P 500 stepped up 0.8%, that's 8 points, finished at 1102. For the week, the Dow rose 3.4%. The NASDAQ drove up 3.3%. The S&P 500 jumped 3.5%. Companies from all sectors cheered investors with strong earnings news today. Verizon buzzed up more than 3.75%. Honeywell hopped up nearly 2%. Ford roared up more than 5%. Apple bobbed up 0.25% today. Intel chipped off 0.4%, but AMD popped up 2.75%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to an even 3%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for June. The Federal Communications Commission and the Food and Drug Administration convene a two-day meeting on life-saving wireless medical technology. And she played the Queen. Oscar-winning actress Helen Mirren turned 65. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Education Secretary Arne Duncan made his way into the regulatory limelight today. The Obama administration is taking on for-profit colleges. Schools like University of Phoenix and DeVry are names you probably know. The White House wants to cut off their access to federally backed aid if too many students default on their loans. Before students get those loans, though, they have to know about the schools, which happens through high-pressure recruiting tactics and what are often misleading ads, ads that the new rules aren't going to change. Sharona Coots from the investigative newsroom ProPublica has the story.
Like so many people, Lisa Jackson spent a lot of time over the last year at home looking online for a way out of unemployment, a new job, career training.
The website I'm going to is blackplanet.com, which was one of the websites that I'd seen the ad on.
The ad, actually there were a few of them, was pretty striking.
The dancing lady, the dancing man, or she comes to the front of the screen and then runs to the back.
The ads caught Jackson's attention, not just because of the gyrating dancing, but because of what they were offering.
$10,000 scholarship from Obama's government. All single mothers are now getting scholarships to go back to school.
Let me repeat that. The ad said Obama's government was handing out $10,000 scholarships to single mothers to go back to school. There are lots of ads like these online. Some appear next to email, others pop up in social networking sites. There's only one problem.
There is no such thing as an Obama scholarship for moms.
Robert Shireman ran the financial aid program at the Department of Education until early this month.
However, moms are eligible for federal financial aid generally, Pell Grants, student loans, and other aid. But nothing specific to moms or single moms.
So what's the deal? The ads are produced by companies called lead generators, who earn upwards of $1 billion a year to find new students for colleges, mostly for-profit. And those for-profit schools are making billions too by signing up low-income students who often pay tuition with government grants and loans. The Career College Association says most of those students are women, and over half of them have dependent children. That makes mothers a lucrative market for for-profit schools. Mothers like Nicole Massey. Massey lost her job teaching high school a year ago, partly because she doesn't have a master's degree. So she was excited when an ad appeared next to her Yahoo email saying Obama wants single moms to go back to school.
When I clicked on it, it then took me to the next page, which was filling your name, your date of birth, what's your highest level of education, and I clicked bachelor's degree.
She clicked through a number of screens where she entered more personal information and selected a master's of education. Almost instantly, recruiters from mostly for-profit schools bombarded her with calls. Massey asked about the Obama grants, but no one could tell her anything. That's when she realized there were no Obama grants for single mums. The ads were just a ploy to get her contact information.
It's misleading, and you have a lot of people who really may not have the money or the funds to go to school, so they're really, really searching for a way to, you know, further their education. So I just feel it's not fair.
One of the companies behind the ads is Experian. You might recognize that name if you've ever needed to get a hold of your credit report. Experian also promotes itself as a source of advice for consumers on how to make good financial decisions. The company refused comment for this story, but in the past, Experian used virtually the same ads it's using for education, only with different text, to generate customers for another industry known for lending lots of money to people who couldn't afford it, the subprime mortgage industry. Priya Raghubir is a professor of marketing at New York University's Stern School of Business. She says it's no coincidence there's an overlap between advertising for subprime and student loans.
Obama has a very, very strong appeal with the younger people, the minority citizens and green card holders of this country, lower income households.
The same groups targeted disproportionately by subprime lenders.
For those groups particularly, he signals the fact that he is something that they would like to associate with, the way he has used education to break a number of barriers and get to where he has at such a young age.
Critics say that sort of aspirational messaging is just one of the parallels with predatory mortgage lending. Barmak Nasirian, who represents college admissions officers and registrars, says the Obama Mum ads are one example of a larger problem, the heavy marketing by for-profit schools.
I believe that advertising is out of control, and I think it is extremely unfortunate that people are being misled into thinking they are taking advantage of a tailor-made, heavily subsidized federal program when, in fact, all they're dealing with is a sophisticated marketing machine.
So who can stop the ads? The Department of Education told us they can't because regulating marketers is up to the Federal Trade Commission. But the FTC couldn't point to any action they'd taken to stop the misleading ads. Even the schools say they're frustrated because they don't always know what techniques lead generators are using to attract potential students. For the moment, it's up to consumers to make sure they know what they're signing up for and how much it will really cost. For ProPublica and Marketplace, I'm Sharona Coots.
The Colorado River flows from the Rocky Mountains down through Utah and Arizona, along the border with California to the Gulf of California and Mexico. Flow might be too generous a word, actually, because we use so much of the Colorado's water in the American Southwest, both for irrigation and development. What used to be a river is actually just a trickle by the time it crosses the Mexican border. Some years, it never even reaches the sea. Today on our series, The Art of Money, what artists and others see when they consider the economy, photojournalist Brian Frank. He has been documenting some of the changes along the course of the Colorado River. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with an image that actually started you on your journey down along the Colorado River. It's taken from a bridge somewhere between the U.S. and Mexico, I guess. I want you to describe it for us and then tell me why it inspired you to tell the story of this river.
I actually was in the middle of working in northern Mexico teaching photojournalism to kids. And as I was driving on the freeway across a bridge into the nearest city called San Luis, I looked down and you can see this giant trough where the Colorado River used to run and used to feed the whole area and all the farms. And even the sign is still there, kind of graffitied and tattered. The best way I could describe it was as a dust bowl. It reminded me of, you know, the old pictures I saw from the Farm Security Administration of just total agricultural collapse. And it made me kind of just question what this area used to look like and what it could look like if the water wasn't being misused.
The sensation that you had of it being a dust bowl, did you shoot and develop your prints in a way to echo some of those great Farm Service Administration pictures?
Sure. I used older cameras and old black and white stock. I felt that that would lend itself to that feel of those older images that are, you know, they're part of our history. I also looked for, you know, images that were a little bit more timeless. You don't really know when these images were taken, whether they were taken recently or taken 40 years ago.
Well, there is this one picture there. It reminded me so much of Dorothea Lange and the picture she did called Migrant Mother. It's you. Your picture is a grandmother in Sonora, Mexico, sitting with her granddaughter, and it just struck me how similar those two images were.
That image is the image that sums up the story for me. It's an image that really shows how this story relates not only to the economy and to agriculture, but also to immigration. This is a family who had their son deported from the U.S. and sent back to live on this farm, which was already failing. And therefore, his whole family came with him from the States because they didn't want to break up the family. And so now this small farm is trying to support twice as many people as it should without the water that it used to have, and the farm failed.
Yeah, it's a story, too, of certainly on this side of the border, you know, it's the haves and the have-nots. You've got a couple of images of kids playing in water. One of them's a kid in a backyard in a well-to-do suburban neighborhood, and the other one is this little girl standing in a what looks like a dirty puddle in a sort of a run-down part of Phoenix, Arizona. It's definitely water gives and water takes away.
I found these scenes, like the ones you're talking about, on the U.S. side as well, these scenes with this huge disparity in wealth and in access to water. It ended up not just being a story about the U.S. versus Mexico. I came across extreme poverty on the U.S. side as well. So to me, that was a shock that I had images that they looked very similar to some of my stuff from Mexico, and they were taken right there in Arizona.
You said you went in search of this cultural story, but it did turn out to be, I think, at least the pictures show, very much an economic story.
Yeah, this thing has a lot to do with money, and it has a lot to do with the economy, obviously. You know, the majority of this water is siphoned off before it gets to our southern neighbor, and it's siphoned off in order to help feed places like Las Vegas and Los Angeles. Without this water source and without the power and agriculture it provides, you know, these economies would not be booming the way that they are, and that many people should not live there. There's no way that that area can ecologically support that population. Unfortunately, that might mean that this problem isn't going to go anywhere.
Brian Frank's photo essay about the Colorado River is called Downstream, Death of the Mighty Colorado. We've got some pictures from it on our website and a link to the full exhibition. It's, of course, marketplace.org. Brian, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note on the way out this week, a rare descent into the world of corporate dividends as a way to measure the economy. Today, General Electric announced it's going to increase its dividends 20%. Sounds really nice, but it is a tad less impressive in real numbers. The dividend's going from a dime per share to 12 cents. Still, though, if you think back to what we said in the wrap about companies holding onto their cash because they don't know what's coming, it is worth a note that a bellwether company like GE is feeling good enough to give something back, even if it is just 2 cents. Anyway, on a Friday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 101 points, just shy of 1%. The NASDAQ up 23 points, just over 1%. The S&P 500 gained 5 points. That's about 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy named J.J. Ewell. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, you think you know the price of your home? Oh, think again.
At the time that I signed the papers for the loan, my home was worth $395,000. At this point, my home is only worth $169,000.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a good weekend. We are back here on Monday.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.